Welcome to Brave Space, a place where we grapple with feminist issues in northern New Mexico. We break it down, and we break it down here on Talk 1260 and 103.7 KTRC, Santa Fe's news talk leader.
I want a revolution.
Good morning and welcome to Brave Space. It's Saturday morning in Santa Fe, New Mexico. My name is Cecile Lipworth, and I'm thrilled to be here once again. It is truly the highlight of my weekend to be on air and talk to incredible people that I have the privilege to do. Before I introduce my guests this morning, I do want to just put out an alert and a notice, not an alert, but a notice. If you are listening and you have any young girls, young women ages 13 to 18 who may be interested in an after-school dance and life skills program, my guest from a few months ago, Mira Crane from Pomegranate Studios, is offering a free program. It's being held at Monte del Sol High School. It is for her SEEDS program, which she talked about, self-esteem, empowerment, and education through dance, a youth mentorship program for social change. It's going to be offered Mondays and Wednesdays from 4:15 to 5:30, starting this coming Monday, September 16th. It's open to everyone. Again, it's free. And if you go to pomegranatestudio.org, or call 505-501-2142. You can register your daughter, a young woman in your life who may want to do it. You can register them to participate. Again, it's going to be held at Monte del Sol, but anyone from any school can attend. It's a fantastic program that has really changed the lives of many young women in our community. So I do recommend, if you want, doing that. This morning, I have some really powerful guests in the studio. Lynn Sanchez, who's a friend of mine and incredible activist and worker in this community for sex trafficking and human trafficking in our state. Lynn is the program director for the City of Albuquerque's Anti-Human Trafficking Initiative. She is the founder and director of New Mexico Human Trafficking Hotline, 505-GET-FREE, if anyone is in a situation of human trafficking, you can phone the hotline, 505-GET-FREE. And she is the co-chair of New Mexico Human Trafficking Task Force, the director of the Anti-Human Trafficking Initiative, and the founder of Sojourners Advocacy Cafe. Morning, Lynn.
Good morning.
And then my other guests are Julia Flynn Seiler, who is a New York Times best-selling author and journalist. She's reading this evening at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 p.m. She'll be reading and being in conversation with Dora Wang and James McGrath Morris. And we're going to be talking about her book, The White Devil's Daughters, The Women Who Fought Against Slavery in San Francisco's Chinatown. Morning, Julia.
Good morning, Cecile.
It's great to have you in the studio.
Very happy to be here.
And Dora Wang, who is the recipient of the Lannan Foundation Writer's Residency and a New Mexico, Arizona Book Award winner. She's the president of the Caucus of Asian American Psychiatrists for the American Psychiatric Association and the author of The Kitchen Shrink, A Psychiatrist's Reflections on Healing in a Changing World. And Dora was very instrumental in working with Julia and reading through the script and giving some feedback and advice. So good morning, Dora. It's great to have you in the studio with us.
Good morning, Cecile.
So this isn't an easy topic to talk about on a Saturday morning. I realize that my listeners probably 9 a.m. on a Saturday morning. We talk about some heavy subjects in this room, but that is really what we're here to do. We're really here to open up and have these conversations that are often really difficult and shed some light that often isn't shed on some of the topics. And, you know, your book, Julia, The White Devil's Daughter, there's definitely this piece of unknown history around, certainly around sex trafficking. It's really such a big topic, and we don't know much. A lot's being brought to light now through the Jeffrey Epstein case, of course, a high-profile case like that. But specifically, the book deals with women, Asian women in the early 1900s who were coming into America, and that itself is a fascinating story, but who were then enslaved in sex trafficking. How did you even start to discover the story of these women, and particular the protagonists in this book?
Sure. Thank you, Cecile. I am fascinated by books that explore the issue of women and power. And I was looking for a story set in San Francisco, which is close to where I live, and ideally one where there was a single setting, a home. And I came across this building that's still standing in Chinatown today. And it was starting in the 1870s, it was a safe house for Asian women who had been trafficked. And it was set up by a very small group of activists, really against the wishes of their own husbands and their certainly their ministers at church. And they saw that there were a very large number of Chinese women who were being brought into the United States, forced into prostitution, and often left to die literally on the streets. And they were shocked, and they wanted to do something about this. They wanted to take action. And again, this is against a backdrop of incredible anti-Chinese sentiment at that time and violence towards the Chinese. And so I was really inspired by this story of a small group of activist women who decided to try to protect others. They called their work women's work for women. They were early feminists, and I argue in the book that they were pioneering anti-trafficking activists.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the setting of what was going on, I think we have to understand in early 19th century San Francisco, American sentiment towards Chinese immigrants was totally racist. Oh, what's new? Things don't change much. But it was totally racist. And so these women were sort of being brought in. And there was the whole story of the political piece of that is fascinating, too. Mm-hmm.
There had been a series of laws passed to restrict immigration of Chinese people, and specifically Chinese women, because there was concern that they were coming for prostitution. The terrible twist at all of this is that the more immigration restrictions that were put into place, the more lucrative trafficking became for the criminals who saw an opportunity. San Francisco at that time, and Chinatown in particular, was a largely male society, and there was huge demand for sex from both Chinese men and white men. And so the trafficking of desperate girls and women, and I should say girls, many times these girls and women who came over were 8 years old, 9 years old, 12, 14. They were very young. But there was just enormous demand. And the average life expectancy during that time for those girls and women who were brought over was something like 4 years. And the conditions were appalling. And what was most shocking to me was that even after the passage of the 13th Amendment following the Civil War, which, of course, outlawed slavery, there were still open auctions of Chinese women taking place in the streets of San Francisco.
Perceive women as being enslaved, right, when it's for sex and trafficking, which we're seeing even modern day. Just before the show, we did look up the statistic, and you know, there's 100. The lucrativeness of human trafficking and sex trafficking. If you can sell one woman's body over and over and over again in a day, they're just bringing in money for you if you're the trafficker. And the statistic is that there's $150 billion profiting in human trafficking, and $99 billion a year in sexual exploitation. So it's a completely lucrative. It was then, it is now. Lynn, are we seeing that here in New Mexico? I know you know, there is a huge lucrativeness to the trafficking in, and New Mexico is one of the states that is a forerunner in human trafficking, maybe?
I think it's in every state, in every community, and it's probably what's helping to drive it is technology. And like you said, you know, a person, they don't have to invest anything into them, and they can use them over and over and over again until they the life expectancy is 7 years for someone who's been trafficked, whether it's due to drug overdose or violence on the streets or by, you know, traffickers. Some people call them Johns if they buy, but I don't really like that term. I think anyone who engages, and that our laws are pretty clear that if you're engaged in buying and selling human beings, you're engaged in trafficking. And I think that technology drives it because it makes it easy for somebody to order a person to purchase a human being, and there is a market for everybody. We've had, you know, she could be 8 months pregnant, and there's someone who wants to sell and buy her. She could be, you know, a 15-year-old girl suffering from, you know, severe drug addictions and stuff, and she's in really poor health, and, you know, there's a market for all, for everybody. So, and men too, men and boys also. I mean, we've had some, you know, worked with some survivors who are male, and there's such a denial about the possibility of a man actually being, you know, trafficked. Like, well, you're a man, you that couldn't possibly happen to you, but it does.
It's a hard thing to imagine humanity when you talk about sex trafficking. It's a really hard concept to wrap our brains around. We're going to come back and talk a bit more with my guests, Julia, Dora, and Lynn. You're listening to Brave Space on Talk 1260 1037. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Brave Space. My name's Cecile. It's Saturday morning in Santa Fe. I'm always thrilled to be here. I want to give a shout out quickly to some people who are listening, because I never know, really. We're in the studio and it feels like we're going out into the thin air. But this week, two people told me that they listen. One from Johannesburg, South Africa, Stacy. So if you're listening this morning, thank you. And Campbell in our little village, he also told me he's listening this morning. And maybe my brother in Toronto is listening. So I just want to give a shout out to everyone who does listen to us. And if you ever have topics and conversations you'd like to hear, you can email me at bravespace@santafe.com or message us on our Facebook page, which is Brave Space NM. And we do like to take suggestions for what you want to hear us talk about. This morning, we are talking about a really difficult subject, something that is often hidden from us and is a very difficult subject matter to actually wrap our heads around. It's sex trafficking and human trafficking. And in the studio, I have Lynn Sanchez, Julia Flynn Silo, who will be at Collected Works this evening at 6 p.m. in conversation with my other guest, Dora Wang, and James McGrath Morris. Dora, you read the book early on, the manuscript. How do you come into the subject matter, and what was your relationship to reading the book? Did you know about these women?
Well, so I've known Julia for almost 20 years now, and was privileged that she asked me to be an early reader of a draft of this book. And I'm so grateful that she has brought this subject to light. Although I grew up in California, I studied at UC Berkeley, and I had not known about this topic, about this safe house, about the character of Donaldina Cameron, about Tien Phu Wu, and how the two of them ran this safe house and rescued, and Julia mentioned, thousands of women from sexual slavery. I'm also struck that, and Cecile, you were mentioning the Jeffrey Epstein case that's been in the news, at the forefront of the news these days. And I had heard his name years ago, and of course he was convicted in 2008. And this trafficking is happening underneath our noses, and we see it. And yet we don't, we see it, but it just seems to go on.
We know it's happening, but we don't really know that we see it, but we don't.
Yes,
is the thing. Massage parlors that are happening on our street corners.
And when we watch movies of the Wild West, right, there's this kind of romantic notion of the brothel. And one thing that Julia does in her book, The White Devil's Daughters, is that she takes a different look at these brothels from the point of view of the women enslaved in them, basically, and she's calling it slavery. And I think that that's something that's been underneath our noses, and we don't recognize it as slavery. And why, one question I have is, why have we not recognized this as slavery all this time? Is it because they are women?
Oh, I absolutely think so.
And are human rights, do they not apply to women? And is it that men are, you know, so we have the Emancipation Proclamation, the 13th Amendment that you mentioned, and so slaves were freed, but yet women continue to be enslaved. Are women not human beings? Do human rights not apply to women?
Well, you know, right now we are fighting for the Equal Rights Amendment, because there is no amendment to the United States Constitution that actually is for equal rights for women.
Oh, my goodness.
So 37 states have ratified it, and they need one more state to ratify it for it to become an amendment. There's a lot of work going on in Virginia right now. So if you are interested, please read up on the Equal Rights Amendment, because it's exactly that thing. When women don't have equal rights and we don't have an amendment, there are no equal rights for women. It is not a human right. I want to go to the characters, Dolly and Tien Phu Wu. Tell us a little bit about them, Julia, and who they were and where they came from and how they got to do this work of rescuing and providing a safe place for young women in early 19th century San Francisco.
Sure. It's hard to imagine women who could have come from more different backgrounds joining together in a fight. Tien Phu Wu was a very young girl. We don't know exactly her age at the time, but she was sold by her father to pay his gambling debts, put on a steamer from Hong Kong to San Francisco, and went to work as a household slave or a slave in a brothel. And she was a very young girl at this point. She was sold from the brothel to two women who abused her and used hot tongs on her arms and burned her badly. And she was so abused that her condition came to the attention of law enforcement, and a policeman brought her in his arms to this rescue home in 1894. About 15 months later, a young woman from a Scottish family who had been hired to teach sewing at this same home walked up those same steps, and she became a teacher in the home and very quickly rose to running the home. Tien was an extraordinarily bright young woman, and she ended up being educated and going to college with the help of the home, and decided that she wanted to come back and help other girls and women like herself. And so it turned out that she and Dolly worked side by side for decades together. And they not only went to brothels and tried to help girls and women who wanted to change their lives, but they went in front of powerful people, and they testified on behalf of victims of human trafficking. And they tried to change legislation and change laws. And they became very prominent activists in this area. And one of the most moving things that I found with these two characters, I mean, you just imagine them. Dolly was very tall and statuesque and had auburn hair and had a Scottish lilt to her voice. And Tien was wore glasses, and she was quite a bit younger, and she was feisty, and she had a great sense of humor. Well, at the end of their lives, they ended up in the same place. They lived together for decades in retirement in Palo Alto, and then they were buried together in the same family plot.
That's amazing.
And it was one of the most moving parts of this story for me, and it was also a way to think about women's friendships and the power of women's friendships and how through working together, women's work for women, there's an opportunity sometimes to make change, important change in our society.
We definitely have strength in our numbers, and when we do work together, and there are often times we don't, but when we do work together, we really can make change happen. I totally believe that. I want to just touch a little bit on the title, The White Devil's Daughters, because Dolly was called the White Devil.
Yes, she was. So she was so effective in disrupting the business of human trafficking in San Francisco at in the late 19th, early 20th centuries that her enemies called her a racial epithet, which was in Chinese, roughly translated, was the White Devil. And in turn, the hundreds and actually totaling thousands of women who came through the home, a number of those women referred to Dolly as Lomo or Mother or Mama. And one of the things that I found in the archives in my research were Mother's Day cards written to Dolly from former residents of the home who had moved to places all over the country and all over the world, from China, wishing her happy Mother's Day. That's where the title comes from, The White Devil's Daughters.
There's so much we can talk about. You really need to go and listen to the book reading this evening and conversation at Collected Works. Again, it's the White Devil's Daughters, the women who fought against slavery in San Francisco's Chinatown. We're going to come back and talk a bit with Lynn because some of the work that's reflected in the book is being done right here through the work that Lynn does in New Mexico. So join us again after the break on Talk 1260 1037 on Brave Space. We'll be right back. I know what I want. Yeah, I want a revolution.
We'll be right back on Brave Space, a place for feminist issues in northern New Mexico on KTRC, Santa Fe's news talk leader.
Welcome back to Brave Space. As usual during the breaks, there's so much chatter in the studio because we have a million directions we want to go in. There's always so much to talk about on all these shows and specifically today. And so I want to touch on some big topics that we have. But Lynn, just coming back to you for a minute of what happens here in New Mexico, and you do have a safe house here in New Mexico, very similarly to Dolly and Tien Phu Wu, the work that they did, where young women of all ages, are given safe space after they have been brought in from sex trafficked situations. Can you tell us a little bit about the situation here in New Mexico?
So we have a safe house in Santa Fe, and we have safe houses in Albuquerque. We'd like to get them set up around the state. It's just really difficult to identify victims because the crime is hidden. Like maybe back in the end of the 1800s, it wasn't so hidden. It was more obvious. But because the crime itself is fueled by technology and also the fact that society isn't aware of it or that we're in denial about it, kind of makes it easier for traffickers to get away with buying and selling people. And so if you don't know it's happening, but you kind of suspect there's something going on, for example, massage parlors. Maybe there's family members that are back in another country, and there's no trust in our law enforcement. There's no trust in our society here that people are actually going to be able to keep their family members back home safe. So they're not going to talk I mean, that's one of the big, on the hotline, that's one of the majority of the calls we get. It's about, you know, the massage parlors. I've had people call and say, I actually talked to a woman who told me she had to work 14 hours. They pick her up, they drive her home, they bring her back. She has no contact with the outside world. But when law enforcement goes in and tries to investigate or people try to talk to them, it's just a wall of silence because of the fear factor. And so that's something that's really, it's a challenge, and it's one of our biggest challenges, I think, nationwide, is how do we, you know, try to reach people who are being enslaved right before our eyes in places like massage parlors and perhaps other, you know, establishments, and just it's hidden that way. And then there's the people that everyone just kind of assumes chose it, and they're working as prostitutes, and they have no choice, and they work through horrific conditions. They're brutalized every day. It's an extremely violent, violent crime. I mean, if they survive, you know, say working for a year, and somebody's like being sold 10 times a day, they have a certain amount of money they're supposed to make. They're working with, you know, no kind of protections for their body. It's not like Pretty Women, that movie with Julia Roberts, and a lot of people assume it is.
That
they think
that somehow glamorous,
reciprocal, that they're getting taken care of, their clothes, they need for clothing and food. And we've had so many different survivors talk about horrific, and there are things they'll probably never talk about because it's such a traumatic experience. And it's not like, you know, Hurricane Katrina or something is like a natural disaster type of trauma. But this is something where you're being brutalized every day over and over again, and you think the world knows it's happening to you and nobody's helping. When they did the sting operation for the Best Choice Motel in Albuquerque about a month and a half ago, there were two little boys who were caught up in it, and they had known what was going on to their mother and other people at the motel. And we heard one of them say, "See, Mom, I told you that somebody would help us. Like, we just had to not give up. Somebody was going to help us." So all this time, these children were thinking the world, you know, believed they deserved it or that it was somehow their fault or whatever.
So, Dora, it just leads into this thing as a psychiatrist, the trauma of this. It's not just affecting the women, because often they have children, often they have families. It is such a sort of systemic piece of life for so many communities and so many women. Even here in New Mexico, you know, we do have all this oil and drilling, and you know, we know that there are sex camps set up for the workers in these extractive industries. I mean, Winola Duke speaks a lot about that as well. So New Mexico is a hotbed for that. But talk a little bit about that piece of it.
I'm just so struck at hearing about these boys and watching their mother. There's, you know, the mother being their source of security in the world, and their mother is being sold, like you said, 10 times. I'm also struck by the medical aspects of this, that, you know, in Julia's book, when these women were being sex trafficked and sold as slaves in the early 1900s, there was no birth control, and many of them were pregnant as they were being sold 10 times a night, sold being a euphemism for being raped, I guess, and your women also. You were mentioning that birth control is something that's they don't take the time for when they're trafficking these women. And Julie, did you have something to say?
Well, The White Devil's Daughters begins with a powerful story of a teenager who realizes she's pregnant, she's been raped by her trafficker. She has one opportunity to escape when she's left at a beauty shop, and she makes a run for it. So she effectively saves herself by finding the safe house. But the implications for the children are so powerful and long-lasting. I've been getting letters from, most recently, from a grand
child of a woman who came through the safe house. And the trauma continues. It lives on. There's stigma attached to it. There's an effort to change the frame in which we look at the women who took refuge there. And my book does try to do that. I focus on the subject of agency, of women helping themselves to get free of these awful, awful situations. But I'm also struck by the issue and the kind of leverage that some of the traffickers have of taking away passports or taking away immigration documents, and the way that I suspect in New Mexico, just like California, that immigrants are especially vulnerable to sex trafficking.
Yeah, I was telling you a story. We were once at an airport in Italy, and there was a man who, I'm not sure if he was FBI or whatever, but we struck up this conversation. We were talking about the work we were doing around violence against women, and he told us the story how they had broken open this case where this group, Filipino women, are some of the most trafficked women in the world because they come from the Philippines into, now they're going a lot to the Middle East, but, you know, even here in America, and they're enslaved. And he told us the story about a group. They were an aeroplane full of women coming from the Philippines into the Middle East, and they were told, we're going to land, and give us your passports so we can help you get through customs quickly. We'll just take all your passports. We'll get you through customs. Don't worry. We'll give you your passports on the other side. Only to find they get off the plane, go through customs, their passports are gone, and they're trapped into sex slavery. So, Lynn, the piece for that is, you know, I know that I think it was Delta Airlines or out of Atlanta, they were doing some training on their airlines to help stewardesses or flight attendants recognize signs of human trafficking. Sometimes there are very specific signs. And one of the things you said is human trafficking and sex slavery is thriving because of ignorance. We ourselves could possibly be walking past something in the street and not knowing that a young girl's being trafficked or, you know, on an aeroplane. And since I read that story, I often get onto a plane and have a look around and see if there's any girl who looks like they might be. It's just a natural reaction now because I learned that. What are we doing to educate, and not just women, not to get involved or somehow become susceptible to it, but how are we educating men to not be the buyers of human flesh?
Well, that's a loaded question. As far as, you know, trying to do something about the market is very difficult. And I think that typically we've got to protect male buyers. And I know CNN did a story called, a documentary called The Girl Next Door. And they featured the 16- and 17-year-old and 14-year-old girls who had been sex trafficked in the cities. And they showed their faces and talked to their family and talked about what happened to them. And then when they visited the John School, they all had paper bags over their heads to conceal their identity. So what I'm seeing a shift over the last few years, and it is there's a more inclusive, you know, the men are getting more involved in trying to shut down demand, not protecting buyers, holding other men accountable, things like that. And I see some, you know, I know some agents within police departments or law enforcement who are very outspoken about it and aren't trying to, you know, they don't talk about it in a way like this is prostitution. They are calling it modern day slavery. They're calling it human trafficking. This is not her choice. Get her, let's get her to resources. Let's get her safe and off the street, and then go after the traffickers. So I think it was about a week ago where they did an operation in Albuquerque, and it was just to find what they call Johns, but I call them buyers, human traffickers. And they identified, I think, 13 or 16 of them, and they showed all their faces on the news. This has never happened, and I thought, wow, that's such a you know, a change, finally. And I think that takes the blame off the victim.
Right.
Puts it where it belongs, on the buyers and the sellers.
Exactly.
You know, and the women who, it's primarily a crime against women. Yes, there's children and there's men that get trafficked too, but primarily it is women. And I think a lot of them carry, not just a spiritual kind of trauma after things like that happen to them, because sexuality is so tied in with people's spirituality in many cultures. And it's also like the physical and the psychological awareness all the time that somehow they're damaged or they're not good anymore and they never will be. And it is a lifetime. Sandy Pierce does a lot of research on the trafficking of Native American women in Minneapolis in the Great Lakes areas. And she herself was trafficked. And she, when I heard her talk, it was probably 3 years ago, she said she had been in recovery for 10 years already, but that she imagined it would be her whole life trying to recover from those experiences. And I think for one person to go through a day of it, or just for to have one example of somebody taking you against your will and holding you, but if you had to do that day in and day out, eventually your psyche. Brain just really breaks down, and the frontal lobe starts to shrink. We know that about trauma, repeated trauma. It really impacts the physical appearance of our frontal lobe, which is where all of our decision making and our view of the world and ourself and all that kind of originates.
We're going to take a break, and as we go into the break, I do want to say, I remember there was an article about either Denmark or Sweden, where they stopped arresting women who were called prostitutes and started arresting the men who were buying the sex from prostitutes, and they switched, they really reduced the rate of prostitution, sex trafficking.
And they're doing that now. I just want to say, law enforcement in Albuquerque and San New Mexico, there really is this effort to not arrest the victims anymore. And there were no arrests in 2019 so far of women for prostitution.
So we have another segment to come back to after this quick break. So you're listening to Talk 1260 1037. We'll be right back on Brave Space.
We'll be right back on Brave Space, a place for feminist issues in northern New Mexico on KTRC, Santa Fe's news talk leader. This is Brave Space, where we break it down on feminist issues here on KTRC, Santa Fe's news talk leader.
Welcome back to Brave Space. We only have a few minutes left, and it's always hard for us to end these conversations, which really get into depth and start being really rich as we move more and more into the topic. But during the break, we were talking about, you know, the whole perception of what sex trafficking is. And Dora said, oh, for the last 100 years, nothing's really changed. But in truth, the millennia, women have been sex trafficked and sold and their bodies used. And Lynn said something really interesting. She said it's not the oldest profession, it's the oldest oppression. And so I just want to round this off of like what it is that is the sort of common denominator, and something which we saw then from your book, Julia, The White Devil's Daughters, immigration, a big thing, taking passports, vulnerable people, right? Vulnerable women who are at risk for this this oppression and slavery. And Lynn, today, I mean, I think, you know, women who are young girls who are vulnerable, runaways from home, you know, drug addiction, it leads into places, into these things where men are sort of capturing the vulnerability of these women and enforcing them. So besides definitely going tonight to listen to this reading and conversation at Collected Works at 6 p.m., how are some of the other ways that we can really start having people learn more and educate themselves around what's going on?
I think The White Devil's Daughters is a wonderful book that really opened my eyes that slavery is happening right under our noses in massage parlors. We've been watching it in movies and westerns. And so applaud Julia writing this book and Lynn's work and how little has changed in the last 100 years, or as you say, last millennia.
And I also think there's such
good reason for us as women to get mad. The headlines we're seeing about the Jeffrey Epstein case, which is really a high-level trafficking case and taking advantage of vulnerable teenage girls for the most part.
And I just want to say, in high echelon society, right? So it's not, we often think about it as, oh, it happens in these motels and low-level, you know, supposedly lives that are not high society, but it's happening in these circles of high society where young women are being passed around from rich man to rich man. That's what the Jeffrey Epstein case is also bringing to light. Lynn, what can people do here in New Mexico to support the work that you're doing?
I would say just, you know, to be aware, to self-educate, to, I mean, in New Mexico, and I can only speak to what I know about what I've seen, it's so obscure that really it's hairdressers who may come across a victim. It's hotel operators, really, and nail people, right? Nail salons. And one of the things we want to do this year is try to pass legislation to make it mandatory for the motel industry, the hotel service industry, hospitality industry, to educate their staff on recognizing the signs of human trafficking. And then if we could also get some kind of mandatory training or education and awareness into the schools, to reach people, you know, as a prevention measure, and also identification, because that Victoria Martin's girl was 7 years old and she was being trafficked, or 9 years old, and she ended up being murdered. And I think that if people had more awareness and training, they might have been able to intervene.
Teachers,
especially.
I just also wanted to say that these victims are young enough that they may not be aware that they're being trafficked.
Right.
The role of childhood is to fit into the world around you.
Exactly.
And if this is the life you are given, the child may not recognize how wrong it is.
Right. So a lot of children are forced into being sold by their parents on a regular basis, and they don't understand that that is not the right thing to be doing. So, Lynn, is there a website people can come to learn more?
We have a 505getfree.org website. The Lifelink has a website. It's www.thelifelink.org, and there's a human trafficking piece there. But there's also, you know, you can just Google human trafficking. Stanford University has a free online training where you can get your 101 human trafficking certificate by listening. And it's really good because it helps you understand what the indicators are. But really, it's such an obscure crime. I think we need to pass more legislation, and also to increase penalties, because it's a 3-year sentence for trafficking somebody in our state, and we need to increase make the punishment fit the crime.
We're going to have Lynn come back to the studio because we have to end here. Please go listen this evening at 6 o'clock to Julia and Dora at Collected Works Bookstore in Galisteo Street, 202 Galisteo. Thank you all so much for being here this morning. I really appreciate this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you,
Cecilia.